The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today is Sonia Jackson. Sonia Jackson is the founder and principal for Mantra for Good, an organization that was founded on the philosophy that good people can change the world and unites people to work on projects to improve lives and our world. Previously, Jackson was responsible for guiding the mission, vision, and strategy for United Airlines Community Investment. Ms. Jackson previously held the post of president of the BP Foundation and senior global business advisor for BP's Global Social Investment Business Unit. Man, that is a mouthful.
That's a lot.
She has also served as executive director of the Sears Roebuck Foundation and assistant director of the Sara Lee Foundation. So, Sonia, we've met, a couple decades ago. We've known each other a very, very long time. And here's, I want to give you my impression of the first time we met. So you're working at this really senior level inside a major corporation, and you did something that I've never seen someone at that level do, which is you smiled and laughed a lot.
Yeah.
How do you do that when virtually, and I mean, I've met a lot of people in these positions where they just don't.
I think there are a couple of things. First of all, in anything that I've ever done, I don't take myself too seriously,
that's a good thing.
I think that you have to be able to laugh at yourself. You have to be able to laugh at the challenges that come your way, and I don't mean to say that in a trite sounding way because it's not intended to be. Mm-hmm. I just think it's really important to be authentic. Life's short; we're not getting out of it alive, and that's why it's important to do the stuff that we want to do. And so, laughter is one of the things that I've always enjoyed.
Be happy because we're all going to die.
Pretty much.
Yeah,
that's pretty much it.
I mean, it's true. Let's be honest. So did you ever how'd that play, though, you're at BP, for God's sakes. How did that play with executives? They let you play.
Oh, my gosh. They didn't always let me play, but they did let me play a lot. I remember the first time I actually started work on American soil and then immediately flew to London because that's where my boss's leadership team, and as part of the leadership team, that's where I was, mm-hmm. meant to be. And it was really incredible because I remember walking up to people going, hi, and I'm an Iowa girl, so we're very friendly.
Right.
And people would look at me like, oh, God, who is this person? And so I guess I just sort of figured out ways to work my authentic personality into whatever I was doing. And ultimately, they didn't look at me with the side eye, but more with the, okay, she may not be so bad after all.
Were you conscious of that in the room at the time?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah?
Absolutely. And I think one of the times I was most conscious of it, I was actually working on a program in South Africa. And there were 11 countries in the South African region that I was responsible for working with. And I was putting together an AIDS program because the HIV outbreak in the employee population was a microcosm of the continent.
Sure.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so when I was working for BP, it was just a few years. I don't want to date myself because I love to lie about my age, but it was just a few years post-apartheid.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, going in and having these conversations and talking about this, one of the most defining moments of my life was after a session that I hosted, most of the employees who were male asked if they could sit with me, and they all surrounded me. Hmm. And it was all of these guys, 11 countries, maybe one or two females, but mostly men. And they were just throwing me questions, asking me, well, how can you be who you are? How are you doing what you're doing? Why do you talk like this? Mm-hmm. And I remember for years, there are several of them that I used to send books, and I would go, there's going to be a coup someday in Botswana or something, and it's all going to point back to me. But it was pretty incredible.
That's wild. wild. Speaking sort of internationally, this is a thing I know about you because it was 2005, and I was on vacation in Canada with my family when Katrina hit. Which was really weird to watch that coverage and be out of country. And I got back a couple days later and I called you not you, I mean, I it might even like checking in saying, hey, you were in New Orleans.
Yes.
So yeah. How did that happen? And this is when you were at United?
I was at United at the time. Yeah. And, you know, that was a place. I actually had an amazing boss when I first joined United who just kind of let the creativity flow. Mm-hmm. And I remember I had worked on the Indian Ocean tsunami, you know, after that issue happened. And I planned the disaster response that United had for that. And we sent body bags and all sorts of things. So when Hurricane Katrina was heating up, I sent her an email over the weekend. And I was watching the news and I said, I'm monitoring this and I'm looking to bring together the team that helped out with the Indian Ocean tsunami. And I'll have a response to you tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And so the next thing I see was an email from my boss to the board and all of the leadership saying Sonia Jackson's all over this, which made me go, uh-oh. Now that really, the stakes are really high. Mm-hmm. And then I got into the office at 6 o'clock the next morning.
It was like a Monday, right?
It was like a Monday.
Yeah,
had
right.
a number of people, you know, who met me because I had set up this, you know, this group that had gotten together before previously for the other event. And at 10 o'clock, I went to her senior staff meeting and said, I need a plane. And she said, you're insane. Mm-hmm. She actually said it in a British accent. Darling, no, mm-hmm. you're insane. And I said, no, I'm really not. I think that because we have a plane, because we have bodies of planes, because we have, you know, all of these assets, we should do this. We should get in there. And so it took several days because of, you know, the flooding and everything. So we were wheels up on Thursday.
Okay.
We went into New Orleans. By the time we were landing, I had the belly of the plane full of water and supplies. I had relief workers on the flight to go and help, including funeral directors who were going to help with. And it's interesting because people always ask me, how do you know that? How did you know that? Well, that's part of the yes and moment.
Yep.
And it's also part of the, you know, just kind of things come. You know, I always say, I don't know why I know, why I knew, but I knew. I knew that there were things that I needed to do. And so as we were landing and people were shooting at the plane, I get a call. I had my phone on. I had both phones on because it was a mercy flight, a relief flight. And so the rules are different. And my staff called and said, Homeland Security seizing the water and food that you have on the plane. I'm like, what? How does Homeland Security know? Well, the story had leaked that United was on the way in and this plane was coming in. And so I had said before I left to the chief of operations that he asked, you know, what was I going to do once we got there? And I said, I want to bring people back. If there are people who need a ride, I want to offer them a ride.
Sure.
And so I had clearance to offer a ride. We had a lot of federal air marshals, 8 federal air marshals on that first flight. And I went into the airport, because I kept thinking people are going to retreat to the airport. And the day that we got there, that Thursday, was when the Superdome had emptied.
Oh.
And so when I walked in holding two phones, people came rushing at me and said, can I use your phone? And I said, sure, you can use my phone, but I'm going to run out of power and there's no power here. So if you'd like to come with me, we'll give you a ride to Chicago and book you anywhere else you want to go. Mm-hmm. And so that ended up happening. And
did Homeland Security take
they
your
did.
Provisions?
They took the food.
To use them and distribute
for people,
them?
Yeah, to distribute them themselves. And so we had amazing employees that were on the flight who were United employees who were mechanics. We had a wheel that was strapped into a seat because there were no control towers.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had mechanics on the flight to repair the plane if the front, you know, if the front, the landing gear broke.
Wow.
We had mechanics to rebuild all the jet bridges. So we were able to rebuild all of the jet bridges so that other airlines could actually park there. It was an amazing time. And United, as a result, ended up bringing back the first 105 passengers that came out of New Orleans, evacuees.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. You talk about crisis management, which is it might strike people as an oxymoron. I don't think it is, and you made the reference as well, which is it's a massive improvisational act. Mm-hmm. So the rules have completely changed. They're out the window. Right. And what do you do? And to be successful with groups, massive groups of people, there has to be general agreement to go places that you've never gone before.
Right. There has to be the general agreement, but there also has to be a collaborative spirit.
Yes.
That everybody has something to contribute because, you know, I always say I didn't speak fluent airline at the time.
Right.
And so having, you know, the guys in operations saying, hey, this is what we need to do. This is
or
what
fluent
you need to
FEMA.
Do.
Exactly. Or fluent any
exactly.
of that, right?
Fluent any of that. And so it was interesting because that United also, when I worked there, we also architected the first flight. I mean, one of the early flights into Haiti by a commercial airline. And United didn't fly to Haiti.
Well, and that's 5 years later.
And
probably.
That's 5 years later. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I always joke because we had 30 slots in to, you know, to fly into Haiti.
Right.
The airline didn't provide service there. And so, again, that collaboration, I was calling people at American Airlines saying, hey, can you help us with our ground game? Because we have food and supplies and people to offload and we have people that we want to evacuate. But we don't have a ground operation here because the airline doesn't fly here. And so there was so much collaboration between, you know, I'm a firm believer, and I've said this about my life. I'm one phone call away from whoever I'd like to talk to.
Right.
And I love playing that out. I love playing out the idea that I can pick up the phone, and even if I don't get the person on the first time, they probably know somebody who will get me to the right person. And so part of the reason that we had the ground game is because Southern Command, the Army military operation, was running the ground game in terms of the flights coming in and who was getting clearance. And I ended up having a lovely conversation. I won't say the major's name, but it was a woman, a female major, and we just hit it off. And so fortunately, every flight ended up getting prioritized in. Like on the weekend, she'd go, can you go wheels up? Because and can you bring this, 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 and this? And it was pretty amazing.
So, all right, you have improvisational chops. Mm-hmm. And I know you took classes at Second
Lots,
City.
Yes.
Yeah, you did.
And
I would suggest that you had improvisational chops before. So another thing that Sonia and I share is a deep and abiding love for jazz, for that art form. And you are on the board of trustees for the Thelonious Monk Institute of Jazz. And that list, I looked at the list of the other people who are on that board of trustees, which I think the technical term is they're badasses. I mean, Herbie Hancock, Jimmy Heath, Wayne Shorter. I mean, you guys just announced International Jazz Day, right, on April 30th. And I mean, I hope you get some high profile.
At the White House.
Yeah.
The president's hosting.
Yeah. The president's hosting? Yeah.
Yes.
And Michelle, right?
Yes.
Yeah. That's, you know, I'm glad you got some people to, that they might know.
Right.
So question here. When you walk through the improvisation door, did you walk through it as a jazz door? Did you walk through it in a Second City theatrical door? I recognize it as all of the above, but I'm curious.
It's so interesting that you say that because I actually credit some of my corporate stuff. I actually said when I'd stepped out of corporate America between BP and United for a short time. And I remember when I got recruited to United, I remember going, oh my gosh, I feel like such a better employee, not only because of the entrepreneurial experience that I now had, but also because of the Second City experience, because I spent a lot of time, you know, during that gap with Second City. And so I think that's part of it. But I also grew up listening to jazz, you know, and growing up in Iowa, where I didn't even know that I was black until I was 8.
Other people did.
Other people did. But I was not sure, you know, even though no one looked like me, except my family. My dad had us listen to jazz, you know, all the time. Mm-hmm. And he had this dream that he would have a jazz quartet with my two older sisters and me. And so we were always, you know, playing instruments. And I think that listening to that improv, you know, because if you don't know jazz and you sort of hear the improvisation of jazz, I've had people go, wait, what's going on?
Yeah, what's that noise?
Or they look like, is that supposed to happen?
Mm-hmm.
I think that probably was the foundation of my improv, you know, listening with my dad growing up. And the other thing I'll say about that was funny to me is that when I go to school, people go, have you heard of Michael Jackson? And I'd go, No, but do you know who John Coltrane is? Making me even weirder.
Yeah. Well, I think Max Roach, the great drummer, yes, had his daughters form a band and ended up being quasi-classical. So they had that sort of bridge between those two words, worlds, which is fascinating. So, all right. So, yeah, you brought this up, right? So you're at BP, just major corporation. You take this break. You study improvisational theater. Great. You go back to United. And this is kind of where you and I started hanging. And then you left.
Yes.
All right. You stepped away from very high-profile corporate career. I think most of us thought you'd go to another, you know, high-profile corporate environment. You haven't.
Right.
Why?
There are a number of reasons. So I stepped away. Let's start with stepping away. I think that I realized, and I think it's really important to be really clear about what your values are.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'd been at the company for 9 years at the time that I left, and the company had changed materially from the company that I was originally recruited to, which wasn't a bad thing. It just was a different thing. And so I remember there were so many times during my tenure at United that I felt like there was more to do. And so I would get recruited, but I'd go, I think there's more that I need to do here, because I was recruited during bankruptcy, and there was a back to improv. There was a lot of opportunity to improvise and, you know, grab onto things to do and be creative in a space that isn't particularly or necessarily creative. And by the time I got to the ninth year and I was working on the merger and integration with this new company, I really kind of realized I realized it probably 2 years before that when the merger stuff started. But I really got to the place where I knew that it was time to go on, because I no longer felt that I was personally in a place to be able to express the creativity that I needed to be able to express in the workplace. I also, you know, a lot of people looked at me with the side eye when I said, I'm out of here. I'm going to go to do something different. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that I'm called to do more. I don't know what that thing is, but I'm going to find it. And, you know, people would go, that's insane. That's crazy. Well, I think it takes a lot of courage to be vulnerable.
Yeah.
And I chose to be vulnerable, and I chose to identify the path that will be the best path for me. And what has happened, you know, one of the things that I loved during my gap and when I was spending time at Second City, I ended up getting really involved in some of the writing classes and have a huge book of sketch comedy that I wrote while I was there. When I went back into the corporate sector, I didn't have that. I was so tired from working, you know, 12, 14, 16-hour days, that I didn't have the space to be creative anymore.
Yeah, there was no book.
And so there was no, you know, there wasn't an outlet. And so I was really a frustrated creative. I wanted to create, but, you know, I was writing a memo, or I was doing a relief flight, or I was doing crisis stuff or whatever. And so it really wasn't, there really wasn't an opportunity to express that. And I remember I took a year off when I first left United. I decided that I wanted to really give myself the opportunity to decompress. Mm-hmm. And what was really interesting for me about that is that be careful what you ask for, because the universe will test that out. And all of a sudden, I started getting recruited again. And I started getting recruited for pretty heady stuff. And, you know, the juxtaposition of having a biweekly paycheck to creating your own economy, very different.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there were those moments where I was going, I could just go back in there and skate, or I can see if this is, you know, if I'm going to play this out. And I chose to play it out. And so it's been an interesting sort of, you know, journey.
Yep.
There was a period of time after that first year, words just started coming into my head. And so I'm writing a ton again now. I'm working on a number of creative projects. And part of that is because I think that in as much as it was stifled, somewhere, it's like using a muscle. Somewhere along the way, after walking away, after leaving my corporate, I always say I'm a corporate evacuee, but after leaving my corporate life, all of a sudden, I remember feeling, some days I feel like there are so many words in my head, they're going to fall out of my ears if I don't put my hands over, or if I don't get to my computer to write them down. And so that's a very different space.
So what's interesting, too, I think, is that there would be a common misconception that someone like yourself leaves the corporate world and you are now in a barn You are in overalls 24/7. you stop bathing, whatever. But in fact, what's fascinating is you have not stopped doing the things you did when you were a knee-deep business person. You are a connector. You are someone who is constantly looking for, oh, have you talked to this person about this idea? You had that idea. I mean, so, you know, I know that we take for granted that the arts has a lot of things that they can teach business. I suspect that you might come from a place where you say business also has a lot to teach people in the creative arts.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So I started studying ballet from a really young age. So art, there's been a thread of arts in my life my entire life. And, you know, when I think about discipline around, you know, getting a project done or around, you know, things that I take on, it doesn't get much more discipline than having to do an hour and a half bar and, you know, and then dance for another hour. And, you know, I dance with a couple of companies, nothing great because, you know, I'm 5 feet tall and not that good. But I did get to dance with a couple of companies. And, yeah, I think that that was kind of the beginning thread. But I think that there is so much that that the arts can teach business. And when you think about going back to the yes and, going back to the improvisational skills, you know, I don't like to say it, but I always tell people, if you don't want honesty, don't cultivate a relationship with me. Corporations aren't nimble. Right. And a lot of companies kind of sit around going, we're pretty nimble and we get it and we're moving fast. And they're really not. And I think improv is such an important skill, an important, you know, asset for corporations, because I think a lot of companies get it, or you'll have people in pockets who get it.
Right.
But one of the things that I see now that I saw during my corporate tenure and that I'd love to see change is that a lot of times the more things people want things to change, they stay the same.
Sure.
Because there's a tug and pull and there's some resistance. And so I think improv could really, you know, help that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, on the other side of that, what I've noticed, both in terms of the work you do and our conversations, is that for people who want to be creative, they have to act. Mm-hmm. And improvisation is also about that. You can't, you know, the default setting for most people is to do nothing.
Right.
That's behavioral science and behavioral economics and all that. Default setting is to do nothing. And improvisation expressly disallows that.
Right.
And that is not necessarily unique to a creative mindset that is sort of like, well, I'm going to flow whenever I'm going to flow.
Mm-hmm.
And it strikes me that again, your business acumen also speaks to, nope, we got to move this thing. Like,
right.
You got to get it done.
Right. And not only that, it also left the courage to say, when, you know, I always tell people that if you don't like my idea, I will write a white paper on you so fast and tell you why you should love it.
Mm-hmm.
And it also creates a level of tenacity, you know, so especially when you know something makes sense and something is good. And that goes back to that collaboration when there are a number of people who are yes anding with you going, okay, we could do that if we do this. And then, yes, and we can do this. Yes, and, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember being at a place, to go back to the New Orleans activity, when the original comment was no. There's no way. This company's in bankruptcy. You're not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And having all of the people around who were yes-anding and who were people from the operations and from all across the business saying, this is why it could work. You're right. It could work. You know, it really created a level of tenacity that, you know, made me stand in the conviction that it had to happen.
Yeah. I don't think I picked up that you guys were bankrupt when that happened, which is a really interesting thing.
Yeah.
And I think that one, again, it's the zag where people think there's a zig, which is, it's often in those sort of darker moments or those tough moments when those are the places where you can act and where you dare. That's where people innovate from.
Right.
They rarely say everything's going great.
Right.
Let's innovate
and
change everything.
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that because the least amount of budget I ever managed was when I first went to United of any company that I ever worked for. As a matter of fact, the budget at BP was so much bigger, it was almost obscene.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember having conversations going, gosh, this was at BP. I remember going, I wonder if they could take I don't know, $100,000 for that project. And I don't know if it's like that now because I don't know anybody inside of BP anymore. So right. I'm adding that disclaimer so nobody calls it BP. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there were people that I worked with at the time would go, well, $100,000 would be good, but I wonder if they could take $1 million. Right? And so I remember, you know, juxtaposed to going to United, a company in bankruptcy, being recruited in bankruptcy, being told my second day on the job that I was at plan. The comptroller for my department said, you're at plan, so there's no more budget for the rest of the year. And I'm like, September. But what that does, what I loved about that experience is that, again, it forced me to improv. It forced me to be creative. It forced me to look around the room and go, well, what kind of assets are there here?
Yes. What's a non-financial way to solve this problem?
Exactly. And so a lot of that, those kinds of things came up, and those kinds of things were created as a result of, you know, not having the resources, the financial resources. And so I really think, I've said it a number of times, but when you have less, it forces you to be scrappy, you know. And mm-hmm. even in my own life now as an entrepreneur, you know, when I had a biweekly direct deposit, it was like, okay, maybe I'll run down to Neiman Marcus or whatever. Mm-hmm. It really makes you scrappy, you know, because you're you know, for me now, I actually have some strong feelings about the legacy that I leave behind. I have some really significant feelings about what that looks like. Mm-hmm. And I've had people say to me, and I disagree, but I've had people say, well, you've left an incredible legacy because you've done a number of things. And I actually believe I have yet to do what I'm going to do. And so as I strive for that and as I push towards that, I have a hunger that wasn't there when everything was sort of, you know, financially easier, I guess, but not necessarily emotionally and personally fulfilling in the same way. I mean, I'm blessed. Don't get me wrong. I feel blessed and grateful for everything that I had the opportunity to do because I learned a lot from it. And I know that there are still ways that I'm using all of that information.
You're an Iowa girl. There's a lot of blue sky out there.
There's so much blue sky. Right? There's always blue sky. Yeah, it really is. That's a happy place.
Right.
Blue sky and corn.
Yes, exactly. Field of Dreams. So the way we close out this podcast, and I could talk to you for, and we probably will, for another hour after this. But what we ask our guest, because the podcast is called Getting to Yes and Yes And being an idea that we've talked about. So in your own life, and there's many, I'm sure, what was a moment that was kind of like, this might have been a no, but it ended up being not just a yes, but a yes and for you?
One of my favorite moments of a yes and, I was taking my parents on a trip, their very first international trip to Vietnam. And people say that's kind of mean. I thought it was pretty cool to take them to Vietnam as the first trip. And I planned 14 perfect days in Vietnam, was working on the visas, was working on getting their passports, and discovered that my mom, who was born in 1939, delivered at home by a midwife, didn't have a birth certificate, which she didn't know. So I decided, I yesed and the you-know-what out of that in terms of calling every place that I could call. Uh-huh. The short story is I ultimately ended up on a call with someone from the Bureau of Vital Statistics in Maryland, which is where my mother is from. And they actually, I don't know if I should say this, but they called me and told me they closed the office and they found the birth record, which had never been filed.
Wow.
And they created a birth certificate and I was able to get her a visa so that she could go to Vietnam. And, you know, my mom can, she can make you pack the luggage for the guilt trip.
Right.
She was going, no, you and your dad just go without me. I'm sure it'll be fun. But anyway, that's probably one of my favorite yes and moments, because every time somebody would say no, I'd say, well, what if you this? And how about we do this? And what if, and it ultimately ended up paying off because they started doing it with me. I was like, there's probably a big box somewhere. There's probably something in the corner somewhere.
This is the thing. I mean, attack with positivity. Mm-hmm. I was at the Social Security office this morning, and my last experience was not good.
Right.
And I went in cynical, jaded, and, you know, unhappy, and I chose to do the exact opposite. I got out of there in 25 minutes.
Yeah.
And they fixed my birth date on my birth certificate. Because that's the problem I had.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, did that today. Sonia, thank you so much for coming to the show.
Kelly, thank you for having me. This was fun.
This has been Second City Works Getting to Yes And. And for more information on Second City's B2B arm, you can find us at www.secondcityworks.com. You can Google us. We're on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. We'll see you next week.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine.
This is Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. You can find us at WGNplus.com. You can stream us on the WGN Plus app, or you can find us on iTunes. See you next week.